You probably are a leader in the church in one way or another. Either you lead by example or you have a position of leadership. So I'm glad to talk about that tonight. And I really like your preacher. And he was at a retreat that I sponsored several years ago. And I respect the fact that he's been here for about a decade. And I've heard some good things about you and your church. Got to meet, spend some time with Becky at the meal tonight. So thank you for honoring me for the invitation to be here. About 35 years ago, a Sunday school teacher of fifth graders in our church asked her class to write an encouraging note to the preacher. And I have kept this note from Kenny Ward for 35 years. On the outside, he drew a picture of a stage with a stick figure on it, standing in front of a microphone, and he wrote to Bob Russell, "You have to be brave to be able to stand in front of thousands of people. I'm glad you're a preacher at this church. I think you do a wonderful job. I'm praying that one of these times you don't mess up." Sincerely, Kenny Ward. You know, I think Kenny Ward had been overhearing his parents talk. And I think he'd heard his parents say, "We really like this church. It's wonderful the way the church is growing. It's great to be a part of a church that's so alive. I hope the preacher doesn't mess up." And that's probably what was on his mind. Well, if I had my life to live over again, I would do many things the same way. I would decide my senior year of high school that I would go to Bible college and study for ministry. I would meet Judy K. Thomas from Rushville, Indiana, and I would marry her. I'd go to Louisville, Kentucky when I was 22 years old to a church of 120 people meeting in a basement of a house. And I would stay there for 40 years. And then I would retire from the located pastorate and turn it over to a couple of guys who are associate preachers. And I would spend 12 years mentoring young preachers and traveling across the country and preaching. So I think I've done some things the way God would have me to do them. But I've also messed up sometimes. I didn't have a big moral failure that made the newspapers, but I made mistakes, and I learned some significant lessons from my mistakes. Sometimes the best lessons you learn in life are from your worst mistakes. Have you ever noticed that? How many of you are married? You might remember some of the best lessons you learned in marriage were from the worst mistakes that you made. My wife and I are very different people. I am a morning person. I feel great at 6 o'clock in the morning. She is a night person. We've been married for 52 years, but really it's only about 25 because I'm up and going in the morning and she's going at night. But after we'd been married about a year, I woke up one morning, went out to get the newspaper, and 6 inches of unexpected, unpredicted snow had fallen during the night. And when I opened up the door, I was just overwhelmed. The snow was beautiful. And the sun was shining, glistening off the snow, it was hanging on the trees. And I thought, this is so exhilarating. My wife needs to see this. She needs to experience this. And so I reached down, and it was packing snow. And I made a snowball, and I went back upstairs to the bedroom, and I crawled back in bed, and I put the snowball on her stomach. I will never do that again. It's the only time in 52 years of marriage that she hit me. I mean, she slugged me on the shoulder. She meant it too. Sometimes you learn your best lessons from your worst mistakes. It's a wise person who learns from mistakes. It's a wiser person who learns from the mistakes of other people. In the book of 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, verse 6, the Apostle Paul has been documenting the problems of the children of Israel as they wandered in the wilderness and they became guilty of idolatry and murmuring and griping. And he said, "These things happened to them as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. And in one day, 23,000 of them died." So Paul was saying, look, learn from the example of the Israelites so you don't make the same mistakes that they did. So tonight, I'm going to share with you some of the mistakes that I made in leadership and the lessons that I learned in hopes that your church, your position of leadership will be enhanced and you'll be able to reach more people for Jesus Christ and you'll be better at discipling your people. For one thing, I learned to confront disagreement when necessary. One of the first mistakes I made as a young leader was a failure to confront. Maybe it's because I'm kind of naive as a person, and I believe all problems will eventually take care of themselves if you just let them alone. Or maybe it's because my Bible college training wasn't very good at learning how to handle a church staff. My practical ministries course in Bible college consisted in how to have a pictorial directory and run a vacation Bible school. And this is long before the day of multi-staff church, and I didn't know much about it. But our church began to grow. From 120 people, we got up to 250, almost 300 people. And our leaders began to say, we need a youth minister. We need somebody who will come in and give attention to our young people. And some larger churches now are having youth ministers. So I said, I think I've got just the guy. He's a friend of mine from Bible college. He's a year older than I am. And he's got a youth ministry in Atlanta, Georgia. And he's having some troubles. I think he's movable. Well, those ought to be three strikes against you. Friend, older, ministry's not going well. But our elders listened to me, and we brought him in, and he was a charming young man, and he interviewed well, and we hired him. And he and I had some good times together. But he wasn't on the church staff very long before I discovered that his philosophy of youth ministry was not the same as my philosophy of youth ministry. As our church was growing, I wanted him to reach as many kids as possible. In his mind, he wanted to get just a handful of kids and deepen them and have them in a focused discipleship group. Rather than sitting down and talking with him about that, I just tiptoed around the edges. I didn't want to lose a friend. I didn't want to make him feel bad. And I thought that he would catch on. But he didn't catch on, and the youth group began to diminish in size. And in elders meetings, some of the elders began to say, you know, we may have to ask this youth minister to resign if it doesn't get better. And I say, oh no, don't ask him to resign. It'll get better. It'll get better. But it didn't. One day, I read an article that he had prepared to put in our church newsletter to promote a teen all-nighter that they were going to have at church. And he was going to label it Teenage Love-In. Now, in light of the hippie culture of that day, and in light of the fact that some of the parents didn't have a whole lot of confidence in him, I didn't think that Teenage Love-In was really an appropriate title. And you know how it is when you've had tension in a relationship, sometimes there's a straw that breaks the camel's back, and I finally got enough courage, and I marched into his office, and I said, I think we need to get another title for this activity. He had sensed the distancing in our relationship, and he dug his heels in and said, I think I know how to impact teenagers. That's what we're going to call it. Now, all of a sudden, I've got insubordination. So I dump too much, too late, and it does not go well. Finally, I say to him, don't you understand? This is the kind of thing that can get you fired. And I marched out, which is really leadership 101. He asked to be on the agenda of our next elders meeting. And he said to the elders, I think you guys need to understand Bob Russell's trying to get me fired. And the elders said, well, that's strange. We've been trying to get you fired for about 6 months. We haven't done it yet. And all seven of our elders said, we think you need to go. He said, I'm not resigning. That's not what this congregation wants. That's not what's best for these kids. And he marched out. Well, that week, he wrote a letter to all the 300 members of our church. And he said, you need to understand that I have been asked to resign. I've had a conflict with Bob Russell and the elders, and I didn't resign. I'm not going to burden you in this letter with the exact problems, but my wife and I will be standing outside church this coming Sunday. We've got a 10-page document showing you all the problems. We'll be sharing that document with you. Let me just pause here for a minute. Sometimes you look at a growing church or a church has a great reputation and you think other churches don't have problems. Every church has problems. Just like every family has problems. And they're not the end of the road. It's just how you deal with those problems that becomes critical. Well, the next Sunday, he was standing outside church with his wife, passing out this 10-page document, quoting, misquoting me and the elders, putting us in the worst possible light. Our congregation is stunned. They thought everything was going well, and now they realize there's a rift in leadership. This guy taught a Sunday school class of about 20 people. They began to meet in his home, and after Sunday school, they would march to church, and they would sit in the first two rows and fold their arms and scowl at me when I preached. And they didn't laugh at my jokes. That was my baptism of fire in ministry, because I am in my late 20s at this time, very young. Strange thing happened, though. About 1 or 2 weeks into this problem, I came home one night, and there were three elders from a church in Cincinnati, Ohio, who said, "Bob, our preacher has recently retired, and we're here to hire you. We'd like for you to come be our preacher." So I went to our elders in the church in Louisville and I said, "I know I'm at the center of this controversy we're going through. I have an opportunity to go someplace else. If you guys think it's wise for me, and if you think it would be best for the church, I can leave at this time." And all seven of them said, "No, we want you to stay. We're going to work through this problem. We're behind you." I came home two nights later, and there was my first ever color television set in the family room, and there was a note on it that read, "This is a gift from the elders. We're not trying to bribe you, but we want you to know we love you, and we hope you'll stay." Well, they bribed me into staying, and I stuck through that problem. I learned something from that, by the way. If you've got unity at the core of your church, you can go through a lot. It's when you have division in the leadership that you have problems. All seven of our elders, the majority of our leaders, were on the same page, and we rode that through. And for a long time, I was so mad at that youth minister. I thought, he tried to split our church. He tried to trash the bride of Christ. Why would he attack the church like that? But the longer I got away from that, the more I understood that really wasn't his problem primarily. It was my problem. I had failed to confront when I needed to. I had failed to set the parameters and explain to him exactly what was expected and evaluate. So I learned some practical lessons. I learned the importance of having weekly staff meetings in which discussions of issues was easier. I learned the importance of regular evaluation in which tough questions were asked. Somebody said, "You keep your accounts current. You don't let them build up the way I did over a period of time." I also learned to wait a day or two before confronting, because if I confront in anger, I exaggerate the problem and I wind up apologizing for overstating the case, and my correction is blurred in the emotion. We do that in marriage all the time. We lash out at each other and then we apologize for the tone, but we never get to the real issue. I also learned you don't have to confront everything. The book of Proverbs says it's to man's advantage to overlook an offense. John Wilson was a mentor of mine, an older preacher, and he once said, "If a church has problems, the leaders have to determine, is it measles or is it cancer? If it's measles, just wait a while and it'll correct itself. But if it's a malignancy, then you've got to confront and deal with it." I also learned that encouragement means a lot more if it's balanced by an occasional correction. If somebody comes to you and always say, "Good job, good job, good job," eventually it doesn't mean anything. But if the same person occasionally comes to you and say, "I really appreciate what you did today," and occasionally they come to you and say, "You know, you said something in your lesson last week I'm not sure I agree with, and let's talk about it," then when they say, "Good job," it means more because you know it's coming from the heart. I also learned that confrontation doesn't take nearly as much time and effort as we imagine. You might know the name of Patrick Lencioni, who is a business consultant. He spoke at our church at a leadership conference. He told of consulting with a particular business where everybody on the ground floor was really restless because a vice president by the name of Fred was telling everybody that the CEO had selected him to be his successor. And nobody had confidence in Fred, and the CEO was pretty old. And they said, what's going to happen when Fred takes over? So on the last day, he sat down with the CEO, and he said, do you know what Fred has been telling people? And the CEO said, yeah, I know he's been telling people I've tagged him as my successor. But that's not true. He's not capable of doing it. And Lencioni said, well, what are you going to do about it? And the CEO said, oh, I don't have the time or energy for that kind of silliness. And Lencioni said, time and energy. How much time would it take? Pick up the phone and say, hey, Fred, this is the boss. I understand you've been telling people I've tagged you as my successor. You know that's not true. It better stop or something bad's going to happen to you. Have a good day. It wouldn't take very long. Why don't we do that? We don't do it because we say we don't want to hurt people. But the real reason we don't confront is because we're people pleasers and we don't want to get hurt. We don't want somebody not to like us. And so the church goes through all kinds of unrest because we don't confront. I really think that 85% of problems the church has would be resolved if we would just practice Matthew 18:15. You know what it says? If you've got aught against your brother, you go to him personally and talk it over between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. If he doesn't listen to you, you take it with somebody else with you, and two of you confront. And then if he doesn't listen, you take it to the church. We do just the opposite. We have a problem, we go tell everybody in the church. What do you think we ought to do? Rather than go to that person individually. Now Galatians 6:1 says, if a brother be overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore him gently. Key word there is gently. It means like a doctor setting a bone. If some doctor's working on you, you want him to be gentle. I had an elder friend in our church named John Foster, who was about 15 years older than I, but he was kind of a mentor to me, and he was an encourager to me. He just boosted my ego and stood by my side. But one time, I said something in a sermon that John Foster disagreed with. I talked about a couple shacking up. And in my generation, shacking up was not a vulgar term, it's a common term. But John, for some reason, in his generation, that was a vulgar term. And so he came to me gently. And he said, Bob, that phrase you used in a sermon last Sunday, shacking up, that didn't sound like a Bob Russell phrase. Isn't that good? He didn't say, I was so offended by that, I just couldn't get over you say something like that. I've talked to 10 other people, and a lot of people out there are really upset about what you said. No, he said, Bob, that didn't sound like something you would normally say. And I received it so much better because he confronted gently and in love. And I told John, I'm not going to use that phrase in a sermon when you're in the audience again. And if we would learn to confront when we have disagreement, and to confront in love, it would solve a lot of the difficulties in church. Okay, here's another lesson I learned. I learned to acknowledge my weaknesses and delegate accordingly. To acknowledge my weaknesses and delegate accordingly. The very worst mistake I ever made in ministry was I forgot a wedding. Look, if somebody confesses a fault, you're supposed to say, oh, we understand, that could happen to anybody. I'm groaning. I've never told anybody that, and they say, I can top that one. No, that's the worst thing you can do in the ministry is forget a wedding. I had a lot of excuses. I had two weddings on the same day, and the rehearsal for the wedding, I forgot, was not on the night before, but it was on Thursday, and it was a small wedding. It was on Saturday, my day off. But anyway, I forgot the most important date on this young couple's calendar. I woke up in the morning and I said, hey, Judy, I don't think I have anything until that wedding tonight. I'm going to take the boys and I'm going to go to the neighbor's Little League baseball game. Well, this is long before cell phones, and Judy had no idea where I was. I came cruising back in about 1:30. She met me in a panic at the door and said, Bob, did you forget you had a wedding at 1 o'clock today? And all of a sudden I remembered I was just sick. She said, well, they got an associate minister to do it. Well, it was our old custodian who just happened to have a ministerial degree in his background. It couldn't have been any worse. And I was heartsick. I said, what am I going to do? I've got to go apologize to that couple. Remember that old saying about if you've got a frog to swallow, don't look at it very long? I said, I've got to get this over with. So I got in my car, drove up to church. I imagined that they're up there getting their pictures taken. Now, it's a 10-minute drive from my house to the church. And I am a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but you wouldn't believe the number of lies that came to my mind on that 10-minute trip. So I got to tell them I had a flat tire. I got stopped by a stalled train. I saw a vision of a 70-foot-high Jesus, and I've been in a trance for 2 hours. I imagined the couple up front getting their picture taken. I walked through the door of the sanctuary, and the whole family was up front getting their picture taken. And as soon as I walked in, the bride saw them and said, oh, Brother Bob, we're so thankful you're okay. We thought maybe you were in an accident and got hurt or something. What happened? And it took every ounce of integrity I've got to say to her, I am so sorry. I forgot. Will you please forgive me? And to their credit, they forgave me, which means they didn't shoot me. But I was so sick. I began to say to myself, I don't belong in ministry. Especially I don't belong in this ministry. I've got this weakness that I overbook myself. I'm not a good administrator of my own time. I don't say no to people the way I should. I ought to just quit. So I said, I've got to make some changes. On Monday, I walked into my secretary's office and I brought my calendar with me. I dropped it in front of her, and I said, I need you to run my life. I am out of control. Here's the times when I will see people. Anytime anybody asks to see me, I'm going to say, I would love to see you, but I don't run my own life. Call my secretary. Anytime somebody asks me to speak somewhere, I'm going to say, I'd love to come, but my secretary runs my calendar. Call her. And I said, by the way, next year I'm just going to do 15 weddings. That year I did 32 weddings, which is a terrible example of a people pleaser out of control. I said, next year just 15 weddings, first come, first serve. You channel the others out to associate ministers. She said, well, in the first place, you're seeing too many people. We're going to cut that number down. And then she got a little committee of people to decide where I was going to speak. And on Friday, my secretary would call my wife and tell her if I had any activities on Saturday, which was her day off. And I'd wake up on Saturday morning, look in the mirror and shave, and there's a yellow post-it note there, what I'm supposed to do on Saturday. Now, I know what you're thinking. It's really unbelievable that God would entrust a ministry the size of Southeast Christian Church to such a goof-off. But maybe that's why. I acknowledged this is an area of my weakness, and I began to gather around me people who were administrative types, and I was willing to turn those responsibilities over to them. And if you were to ask one of our elders, is Bob Russell a good administrator? That elder might say, no, he's terrible. But if you'd ask another elder, is Bob Russell a good administrator? He would say, he really is. He's become a good administrator because he recognizes that's an area of his weakness, and he's allowed other people to take over some of the responsibility. And I discovered when I did that, all of a sudden, I had some margin in my life. I had some weekends that were free. I wasn't missing appointments. I wasn't as frantic as I was before because there were people around me who were shoring me up in the areas of my weakness. Now, I've got to tell you, this is not always easy. After I made that decision, maybe 6-8 months later, I was walking through the sanctuary one Saturday morning. Custodian was setting up for a wedding. I said, somebody getting married tonight? He said, yeah. I said, who is it? And when he told me who was getting married, my heart sank because it was a daughter of a family I'm really close to. So on Monday, I went back to my secretary and I said, look, I said just 15 weddings next year, but when somebody like that asked for me, make an exception. She said, they didn't ask for you. Now, that's okay for you to smile, but I'll tell you what. If you're in a leadership position, you know that kind of hurts your ego. And I think a lot of the problems we get into in leadership are the result of ego. We like being needed. We like being in control. We like to think that nobody can get along without us. But it's only when we're willing to admit our weaknesses and release responsibility to others that life becomes easier and leadership becomes more effective. So my challenge to you, regardless of your sphere of influence, delegate to others, even if it hurts your ego. It'll be better for them. Delegate and don't micromanage. The person you delegate to will do it a whole lot better if they own the program themselves rather than they feel like that you're hovering over them and they've got to answer for every detail. And delegate in the area of your weakness and stay in the area of your strength. The longer you have a position, the more enjoyable it ought to be to you, because more and more you're focused on the area of the things that you do well and you release those things you don't do very well. Delegate to gifted people and help them to look good. When Johnny Carson died, there were a lot of entertainers who were asked, why did you like to go on The Tonight Show? And almost all of them said the same thing. They said, they didn't pay very well, but I'll tell you what, Johnny Carson made you look good. He took the spotlight off himself and put it on you, and he would laugh at your jokes or he would compliment you and put the spotlight on you. That's your job as a leader in any sphere. Jesus said, now the Gentiles love to lord it over people. Not so with you. The greatest among you will be what? The servant of all. So when you have people you oversee, you be their servant. You give them the parameters and say, here's what's expected. You encourage them and you praise them, but you delegate and get out of the way. I really think, I'm convinced, the primary reason most churches don't grow beyond 200 people, or they reach a point where they stagnate, is the failure of delegation. I don't know a whole lot about this particular church, and we have people from other churches, so I'm speaking from ignorance about your particular situation, but I've observed a lot of churches. And in most churches, the preacher is kind of like Moses in the wilderness. Remember, Moses sat from dawn to dusk counseling people and dealing with problems. And his father-in-law came out and said, what are you doing here? He said, well, the people need me. And Jethro, his father-in-law, said, this is not good. The people aren't really getting very good counsel because you're in a hurry and you're wearing yourself out. You better delegate to judges under you. Let them take care of the lesser problems and you just deal with the major problems. So, folks, the church cannot be a pyramid with one guy at the top meeting everybody's needs, or two or three people at the top meeting everybody's needs, or the base can only be so large. We've got to get our concept that the church is a circle where we train people to minister to each other. And if we train them to minister to each other, there's no limit to the size that the circle can be, and the church can still be strong. That's what the Apostle Paul was getting at in Ephesians 4 when he said, God gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be pastors and teachers. To what? To prepare God's people for works of service so that the body of Christ will be built up. But what happens in a church, one preacher or a staff of two or three people can be a chaplain to 200-300 people, and everybody can keep everybody at least semi-involved. But when you make a transition and you allow the leaders to delegate, more and more people are involved and the church becomes stronger. Now, there are three barriers to that. One is time. Just like your child comes to you and says, tie my shoe, you tie the shoe. Tie my shoe, tie the shoe. And eventually you take the time to what? Teach that child to tie his own shoe. But it takes time to do that. And it's a lot easier to get the job and do the job yourself than it is to recruit somebody and train them and give the parameters. But we have to take time to delegate. The second challenge is ego. I already mentioned that. It's hard to release things and you're no longer in control. I remember one night I was walking through the vestibule of the church, the lobby of the church, and a woman came to me and she said, can you tell me where the cancer support group meets? I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. But I'll find out for you. So I went to the Welcome Center and I got out the chart and I found the room and I walked her to the room. I didn't mind telling her, I don't know where the cancer support group meets. I didn't really have the courage to tell her, I didn't know we had a cancer support group. Now, should I get mad because I don't know that? No. That means our pastoral care department is doing a good job. Elders, leaders, if you think that everything's got to come through you and you've got to know everything that's going on, you're a pyramid and the base's only going to be so large. We've got to get to the place where we trust one another and we say, it's not about me. It's about ministering to people. The third barrier is the biggest barrier, and that is support, leadership or lay support. What happens is in a church meeting, we can say, okay, we all buy into this, but when it gets down to we get put on the spot, we back down. Let me give you an illustration. I went to our elders about maybe 20 years into my ministry, and I said, guys, things aren't going very well for me. Looks like things are going pretty well in the church, but I'm burned out. And there are so many things I'm not getting done. I need help. And they could have said, well, you're finding out what it's like to work. You know, we all got work to do. But they said, no, Bob's telling us the truth. Let's help him out. And they began to say, you know what? You're preaching on Sunday night. You don't have to do that anymore. Have somebody else preach on Sunday. We don't expect you to go to all these class meetings. And then one guy said, you do quite a bit of marital counseling. I said, yeah. They said, you're really not very good at it. We'd like for you to cut that out. And it's kind of dangerous. So when somebody asks you to do marital counseling, you tell them, the elders asked me not to do marital counseling. Greatest word I ever learned in ministry was the word referral. Sorry, I'd like to counsel you, but the elders won't let me do it anymore. There's referrals. They got better counsel. But they said, how often do you go to the hospital, Bob? I said, well, I probably go 3 times a week. They said, here's what we'd like to do. We're going to go ourselves, or we're going to recruit people with mercy gifts in the church. And we'll have somebody in the hospital to visit our sick every day. And they can pray with them, and they can read scripture, and they'll minister to them. You go to the hospital only for people who are terminally ill. So I announced to our What We Believe class, I announced to the whole church, look, we all like the church is growing, but understand the church is not a pyramid. It's a circle where we're going to minister to each other. So we're going to train people with mercy gifts, people who really care about you. And they're going to come visit you in the hospital. I'm only going to go when you're terminally ill. So if you're in the hospital, you don't want to see me coming. That's a bad sign. Shortly after that, we had one guy in our church. I was going through Baptist Hospital to go to intensive care to visit with somebody. And this guy had minor surgery, and he's standing outside his room in his robe. He sees me. He said, you're not coming to see me, are you? You're kind of the Grim Reaper. No, I'm not coming to see you. I'm going to tell you, here's what happens, leaders. We all buy into that. And then one Sunday after church, Mrs. Langley, 81 years old, comes to one of the elders, and she said, I was in the hospital for 7 days, and the preacher never came to visit me. Now, what does that elder do? Does that elder say, Mrs. Langley, that's not like Brother Bob. He really cares about people. I'll talk to him, and we'll get it smoothed out. And he comes to me before I get up to preach. He says, Mrs. Langley's a little upset. I think you'd just give her a phone call. She'd feel better. No, that's bad leadership. That elder needs to say, Mrs. Langley, were you terminally ill? Are you still alive? Are you here? Remember, the church is not a pyramid. It's a circle where we minister to each other. Did somebody come to visit you every day? Yes, somebody came. Well, quit your griping and sit down. And then quit your griping. Now, who said amen? Preacher said amen. Now, when we have that kind of unity at the core, and we all buy into understanding about the church being a circle, not a pyramid, then we're ready to delegate and move on. Okay, here's the third mistake I made in ministry. I learned to give my family priority even when the church needs attention. When I first started at Southeast Christian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, I was 22 years old, and I knew I was in way over my head. I was from the country. I grew up milking cows. This church was in the city. I grew up in a little church of about 50 people. This church had the potential to grow large. I had a BA degree from Bible college, and this church had people filled with people with PhDs. So I said, I have really got to be focused and if I'm going to survive here. So I was gone almost every night. I was real focused on getting the church to grow. And I neglected my wife. We'd only been married a year. I would take her to church and forget about her until it was time to go home. Sometimes when it was time to go home, I'd say, could you wait in the car for me a little bit? I've got to counsel with somebody really important. I'd let phone calls interrupt me at night. And I have the greatest wife in the world. She never complained. She did confess years later she was lonely at times. One of the worst things I did when I was home, I wasn't really home. You know what I mean? I would bring sermons home to write and phone calls to make, and I'd talk to people all day long. When I got home, I just wanted to veg out. I didn't want to talk to anybody. And so the person who meant the most to me, I gave the least amount of attention. Finally, I grew out of that. Wives, we do grow up sometimes. And several things happened. We had kids, and I began to realize how important they were. But one night, I got a telephone call from my wife telling me that she was going to come home late. And I answered the phone so late that the answering machine kicked on and recorded my conversation, and I didn't know it. About 10 minutes later, I got a message on the answering machine. I pushed the button, and I couldn't get over the lilt and the energy in my wife's voice and the deadness in mine. Conversation went something like this. Bob, you having a good day? Okay. What are you doing? Reading newspaper. Well, I just called to tell you we got hung up here at work. I'm going to be about an hour late. Okay. Well, do you want me to bring something home to eat? Do you want to go out to eat? What do you want to do? Doesn't matter. Okay, see you later. Bye. And when I listened to that, it really convicted me. I had just read a chapter in a book called Are You Fun to Live With? And I said, I'm no fun to live with. Man, if I die, I want Judy to shed at least one tear, you know. I said, I knew in my heart, if that had been the average person at church that called me, and said, Bob, you having a pretty good day? Yeah, pretty good. How's yours going? What are you doing? I'm reading newspaper, reading this article about U of L football. Have you read that? You need to read it. Well, don't you hurry to come home. Don't want you to have an accident or anything. But my wife, the person who means the most to me, yeah, okay. And I said to myself, that has got to change. And I began to learn to shift gears. And I learned to say at the end of the day, 5 o'clock, whatever it was, when I left church, Lord, that's the best I can do today. I know there are emails that need to be answered, and I'm behind on my sermon. I'll get up early tomorrow morning. But I'm not taking any work home. I'm going to walk through the door of my house. I'm going to give energy and focused attention to the people who matter the most to me. Ben Merrill, a friend of mine in ministry, says that every place he lived, he pounded a nail in the door between the garage and the house. A lot of people thought that was to hang a hat, but he said that's where I symbolically hung all the junk that happened during the day so I could leave it there and give attention to my family. And you know what? My wife and I have always had a great marriage, but it got so much better. I began to laugh more and tease her more, and our companionship got deeper, and the latter two-thirds of our relationship been even better than the first two-thirds. Shortly after I made that decision, one night we were serving some teenagers in the kitchen of the church, serving them pizza. My wife was doing the serving. I looked across the table at her, and she looked really attractive to me that night, and I winked at her. She looked away like she was embarrassed. About 2 hours later, she came up behind me when I was sitting in my easy chair in a family room. She grabbed me around the neck and kissed me on the back of the neck. She said, you know what that does to me when you wink at me in public? I said, no, I found out, but I'm going to do it again. Listen to me. It's a big responsibility to be a leader in the church of Jesus Christ. It's really important that you give your best. But long after the elders forget your name, long after people in the church have forgotten all about you, hopefully your mate will still be there. And they're the people who deserve your best attention. I think the best thing, remember the old thing about the best thing a father can do for his children is to what? Love their mother. The best thing church leaders can do for the community is for you to model what family is all about. If people came in here and they saw some of us older people holding hands with our wives and hugging and letting them get in the car before we took off, and you know, just basic things, I think the church would be so contagious you couldn't keep people away. Okay, here's the last lesson I learned about church leadership. I learned to be content regardless of statistics. Now, this is a lesson most of us know in our heads, but it takes a while to make its way into our hearts. I forgot to ask you, when am I supposed to quit? If my time's up, I'll just quit now. If I can go 10, 15 minutes more. If I'll go till everybody's gone. Okay, we'll do it then. I'll go about 10, 15 minutes more, quit. I am a competitive person by nature, and I'm driven to do my best. I don't think that's bad. Paul Harvey used to say it's each tree striving for a place in the sun that makes them all grow tall. But if not controlled, ambition can be the seedbed of discontent, jealousy, and compulsive behavior. In the early years of my ministry, Bill, my mood during the week was determined by whether church attendance was good on the previous Sunday or not. And no matter how good things were, it was never good enough. I've often said 95% of Southeast Christian Church was great. One of the best churches I've ever seen. 4%, however, was not so hot. And 1% was nasty. And my problem as a leader, 50% of my attention was focused on the 5% to correct it. What happens in elders' meetings? You're going to correct these problems. And you lose the big picture. And every once in a while, you need to step back and say, God's doing some really good things here. People are edified here. People are helped here. People are brought to Christ here. In Philippians 4, the Apostle Paul said, I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation. I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. That means contentment is a learned virtue. Now, I cannot point to a dramatic moment when all of a sudden this impacted me. But over a period of time, I reached a point where it was more about Christ and less about me, and my contentment wasn't determined by the number of people in the pew. I never lost my zeal for the church or evangelism, but I learned to be content regardless of the circumstances. There's a popular poster that's a picture of Alaskan sled dogs taken from the back, from the perspective of the driver, and all you can see is the back end of the dogs. And the caption reads, if you're not the lead dog, the scenery never changes. Is that you? Have you got to be the lead dog or you're discontented? If so, you're going to be miserable because there's always somebody's church has more. Somebody has a nicer facility. Somebody whose preacher's more dynamic. Somebody's music's better. Somebody's attendance is higher. And you're miserable. So, I want to suggest to you 5 keys to contentment. 5 reasons not to get panicky if the numbers in your church aren't always climbing. Number one, everybody hits an occasional plateau. Don't panic. Every organization that grows hits a plateau. Jim Collins in his book, Built to Last, talks about mountain climbers stop on the way up the mountain and establish a base camp so the stragglers can catch up, so the advanced scouts can go on ahead, and then they go on from there. And church growth is like that. You do hit plateaus on occasion, so don't get panicky. Number two, numerical growth is mostly beyond your control. There are so many factors that determine whether the church can grow. Your location, other churches in the area, the harmony of your church, the talent of the people, the mood of the country. And right now, a hostility toward Christianity and the hostility toward the church is mounting to the place it's going to be tougher, in my opinion, it's going to be tougher and tougher for the church to grow in the future. Thirdly, most people you want to impress really don't care anyway. You know, Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes, the 4th chapter, verse 8, there was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked? Why am I depriving myself of this judgment? It's all meaningless. And when you get upset because your organization isn't growing or your church isn't posting the kind of numbers that you want, ask yourself, am I really doing this for Jesus Christ, or am I trying to impress people? Who am I trying to impress? You know, my grandchildren could care less whether I preached in a church of 18,000 or 18. They want to know, will I get down and play the Wii with them? And the people who matter most to you are not going to be impressed with statistics. They're going to be impressed with relationships. Though we want the church to grow, think about who you're trying to impress. Number four, the appetite for more is insatiable. Take it from a guy who preached in a growing church for a long time. Enough is never enough. Our church was listed one time as the 6th fastest growing church in America. I got an ego boost out of that for about 10 minutes. Then you know what I started thinking? Wonder who those other 5 are. Are they telling the truth? Can we beat them next year? Because if you're in competition with other people, you're never satisfied. And number 5, God evaluates your worth not by statistics, but by faithfulness. How does God evaluate this church? Whether you have 350 this Sunday or whether you have 400? No, he wants to know how many are genuine. How many are faithful? Jesus said, the sower went out into the field to sow, and some seed fell on hard soil. It didn't produce anything. And some seed fell on fertile soil, but even there was different soil. Some produced 30 and some 60, some 100-fold. Communities differ. And the difference so many times is not in the sower, but in the receptivity of the soil. I got to sow the seed of the gospel in an area of Kentucky, in Louisville, Kentucky. It was fertile soil. But I grew up in an area in Pennsylvania where the soil is hard. Totally. The Apostle Paul, who preached at Berea, same guy who preached at Thessalonica. Response altogether different because the people in Berea more noble. John the Baptist's numbers went down the 2nd year. Big time. Jesus didn't say, boy, John the Baptist blowing it. No, he said, no greater man born to woman than John the Baptist. So while we're working to be the best leaders we can, to reach as many people as we can, I'm going to talk about that tomorrow morning, how we can be the most dynamic church we can possibly be. But let's recognize that we don't get discouraged because the numbers aren't perfect. The numbers aren't always going up. Because we're not here to evaluate by numbers, but by faithfulness. I'm going to close by showing you a picture on the back of your handout. Is there a picture of a church there? That's a picture that demonstrates the importance of faithfulness. That's a picture of my home church in Meadville, Pennsylvania. First Christian Church, Meadville, Pennsylvania. That picture is taken in 1941. You've all got these black and white photos in your album. This is the kind of church people make fun of today. You look at those people, that's not a very impressive group of people. People say, what influence could that group possibly make? This is Meadville, Pennsylvania. Anybody know where Meadville, Pennsylvania is? It's about 40 miles south of Lake Erie. It gets a lake effect snow. I think the 3rd highest snowfall of any city in America. It's kind of a depressed area today. I showed that picture to a group of preachers, and one preacher came to me and said, Bob, I grew up in Meadville. He said, I was in the 8th grade before I discovered the Lord's Prayer was not, deliver us from Meadville. But before you laugh about these people, I want to tell you about the influence of some of these people in this church. 1941. On the front row, 3rd from the left, a little woman with a white collar and her hands are folded in front of her. Her name is Sue Anderson. She was our church organist. She's married to a guy on the far right, the front row. He's got his hands folded in front of him. His name is Homer Anderson. He was a mailman. Now, maybe they were having some marital problems on this day, but they kept it together for the most part. I don't know why they're separate in this picture. But they're just salt of the earth people. They have a daughter, Donna Cole, a contemporary of mine, who became an executive with a missionary organization called Team Expansion, helping to send out missionaries all over the globe. Her daughter's a missionary. Her son is Tim Cole, went to school with Bill. Tim Cole has been in charge of all the new church plants in the state of Virginia for the last 20 years, done a really good job. That's Homer and Sue's grandson. On the very far right is Stanley Batre. He married a little girl, about two or three in front of him in the front row, Mabel Batre. This picture is 1941, just before World War II. After Pearl Harbor, after World War II was over, Stanley and Mabel Batre decided that God was calling them to be missionaries to Japan. And they spent over 30 years as missionaries in Tokyo, Japan. There are Japanese people in heaven today because of First Christian Church, Meadville, Pennsylvania. In the middle, in the second row, are Edgar and Eva Pressey. Eva's holding a little baby in white. See that couple there? Not very glamorous people. That little baby is Arnold Pressey, who is a preacher in North Carolina today. But when Arnold Pressey was a little boy, his parents were not very well schooled and disciplined. They let him run wild, and he was a holy terror in our church. People kept saying, that little kid is going to burn this church down. Somebody needs to control him. My dad taught Arnold Pressey in the fifth grade. On the way home, he'd say, Arnold Pressey is going to wind up in the penitentiary. You can just write it down. But he's a preacher in North Carolina today. On the back row in the middle is, in the gray suit, is Charles Ward. He was an elder, kind of a legalistic, stern elder. Everybody's a little bit afraid of him. But he had a granddaughter, Dorothy Haddenham, who became a missionary to Alaska. And he's got, I think, three grandsons in ministry today. On the front row, in the very middle, are my mother and father. And they're holding my older sister, Roseanne, one of six children that my parents had. If you look carefully in that picture, my mom and dad are the only people in the entire picture smiling. Somebody told me that's because they haven't had you yet, and I think that's probably true. I wish you could have known my dad. My dad was the 17th of 18 kids. His mother died when he was three. His father, after whom I am named, was not a good man. He was a coal miner, an alcoholic, a womanizer. So my dad grew up in a very non-Christian, dysfunctional home. But at age 19, it just so happened he met my mother, who was a Christian. He became a Christian and never looked back. He got a job working at the Talon Zipper Factory, blue-collar worker, in Meadville, Pennsylvania, scraping to get by with six kids, but one-tenth of every paycheck goes to the Lord. We're in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. We don't have the option of not going. When I'm in the seventh grade, my parents helped to start a new church in the little community we live because we were traveling 15 miles to go to Meadville. And my dad loved that little church of 35 people. First one there, last one to leave. But one of our early preachers skipped town, leaving a lot of unpaid bills. And my dad's so concerned. Our church is going to have a bad reputation in this community. Preacher didn't pay his bills. So my dad went to the bank, borrowed $2,500 of his own money, and paid off all the preacher's bills. And then he took a second job working in a sawmill to pay it back. Now, when you got a dad like that, you're going straight into ministry, whether you want to go or not. So I became a preacher. I've got a brother who's a preacher. I've got two sisters married to preachers. I do have one sister who's a black sheep. She married a deacon. But you've got people you're ashamed of in your family a little bit. My parents have, I think, five grandsons in ministry, great-grandson in ministry. On the back row, on the far right, tallest guy in the back row, D.P. Schaefer, the preacher. D.P. Schaefer's son, Raymond Schaefer, became the two-term governor of the state of Pennsylvania. Served on President Nixon's cabinet for a while. I show people this picture and say, what a great church. No, very average church. Never grew beyond 180 people. They had their problems. Not too long after this picture was taken, they asked D.P. Schaefer to resign because nothing was happening in the church. But look at that church 70 years later. The influence of that little church in Pennsylvania all over the world. Japan, North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, all over. Now, how do you measure the influence of this church, your church? Jesus said, I'm going to build my church. Gates of hell won't prevail against it. You be the best leader you can be. But here's my question for you. 70 years from now, when somebody looks at a picture of your church, after they get done laughing about how you're dressed, what your hair looks like, what are they going to say about your influence? That was my preacher. That was my Sunday school teacher. My small group leader. That was our elder. Hadn't been for them, I guess we wouldn't be Christians today. I look at D.P. Schaefer, I can hardly keep back tears. Hadn't been for him, my dad never would become a Christian. I wouldn't be here. So here's my challenge to you. You be the best leader you can be, but don't grow weary in doing good. In due season, you reap a harvest if you don't give up. Thank you.
I know we can look back.